I'm Sean Graham, and what's old as news this week is absinthe. Yes, the famous green drink with the very high alcohol content has made a resurgence recently and is becoming a popular feature of many a mixed cocktail, but the Green Fairy, as it was known, was banned by French officials back in 1915, and that ban stood for almost 100 years, leading the drink to develop almost a cult-like following. As legends were told, mythology grew about the drink, and that is the subject of a new book by Nina Studer entitled The Hour of Absinthe, A Cultural History of France's Most Notorious Drink. And in this book, Nina goes through the, as the title suggests, cultural history of absinthe. Looking at the origins of the drink, it's actually a Swiss beverage, not a French beverage, and how it became such a popular part of French culture. Certainly the significance of its consumption by French soldiers, and then, of course, its ultimate prohibition in 1915. And it's a fascinating window into not just the drink itself, but certainly how cultures assess and think about questions surrounding consumption, particularly the consumption of alcohol, as it relates to different groups of people. What is good for, say, upper class and wealthy folks? Is that the same standard for working class individuals? Is there a same standard for men and women? And those are the types of questions that this book gets into, and certainly also questions related to colonialism when it comes to consumption by French soldiers. So again, while the book is about absinthe, it is really a portrait of a wide swath of French cultural questions and French cultural issues. And actually, frankly, it really does go beyond French borders as well. It addresses some of these really big questions that we confront in history. So I was really excited to have the opportunity to go through the book, and even more excited to speak with Nina about it. So I really enjoyed this conversation. Think you will as well. So without any further ado, let's get right into my chat with Nina Studer. All right. And Nina Studer joins me now. Nina, how are you today?
Yes, I'm well. I'm finally a bit of sun here in London, so it's better after that miserable winter.
yes. We're starting to come out of it. Same here. It's starting to come out of that winter doldrums, a little more light. I actually walked home in the light yesterday what feels first time since November, I think. So starting to come out of it here, and very excited to talk to you about Hour of Absinthe. Now, before we get into a lot of the content of the book, for anyone who doesn't know, like me, I mean, I've heard of absinthe. I probably have had a drink of absinthe at some point in my life, but I don't really know what it is and what it is made of. So what is it, and why is it so associated with France?
Yes. So first, what is absinthe? So it is a highly alcoholic wormwood-based aperitif. With a very strong aniseed taste. And it is, historically, it had between about 45 and 75% alcohol. The higher the alcohol content, the higher the quality. That was how it was viewed historically. And today you can find absinthe with an even higher degree of alcohol, so you can literally find 95% alcohol absinthe. So it's and so to this highly alcoholic spirit, spices and different herbs or essential oils made from herbs were added, or are added again, and every distillery has their own recipe as to how to do it. And so the plants and spices that have been traditionally added to absinthe consisted of aniseed and wormwood, the two most important ones, but also fennel, lemon balm, cinnamon, cumin, mint, marjoram, all kinds of different herbs and so on. And the alcohol itself, first it was grape-based, so distilled alcohol made from wine or grapes. And then after the phylloxera crisis in France, it switched to other kinds of alcohol. So that's beets, potatoes, etc. And the second question, why is it so associated with France, is interesting because it's a Swiss drink. Hmm. So it comes traditionally from Switzerland, and it was popular first in Switzerland, in this very specific part of Switzerland, the Val de Travers, in the west of Switzerland. And it only crossed across the borders because of tax reasons. Mm. So that's why Pernod, whom we know today because of their pastiste, they made a factory, built a factory across the border in Pontarlier. And then it became popular very slowly in France. And it really only became popular after the military conquest of Algeria. And that is what I'm most interested in as a historian of empire. Mm. Yes.
Yeah. And just out of curiosity, what gives it the color? Why does it have that green color?
Yeah, that's apparently just these different essential oils in it. Mm. So, yeah, it's a mix of those spices. And not all of them have that green color. So... Mm. They're also called, the different ones are also called the white one or the blue one. It's called traditionally the blue one in Switzerland. So not all of them have this color that we associate with the drink, but it's apparently the mix, yeah, of spices. And then it's a drink that Lucius, which means that you don't drink it pure. Don't do that, please. Add water to it and often sugar. And that's when it becomes milky and that's the other color associated with the drink.
Yeah, if it's those 95% ones, yeah, definitely don't want to be drinking those straight. No. I want to be doing shots of that. Does it have the same, obviously the book is about France, but mm-hmm. as a Swiss drink, what is the difference culturally that the Swiss have towards the drink when compared to the French?
Yes, so it was viewed in the 19th century, so once it started to become a not a merely local drink in the Val de Travers, but when it spread further in Switzerland, throughout the French part of Switzerland, it only was popular in the French part of Switzerland. It was viewed very similarly to France, all in all. So it was this drink that was consumed after work, in the company of others, in bars and restaurants, a drink of leisure, a drink of companionship and sociability. But the interesting thing is that after absinthe came to be prohibited, so that was in 1908 in Switzerland and 1914-15 in France, Switzerland started to have this very strong tradition of secret absinthe drinking. Mm. And that, of course, also existed in France, but not to the same degree. So throughout the almost 100 years of it being prohibited in Switzerland, there was this strong idea of that was a local tradition, a specifically Swiss tradition, and people continue to consume it hidden away. And there is this whole folklore nowadays about these years where it was forbidden and where the Swiss drank it almost as a form of resistance towards the government, so to speak. So, and that you can't really find that idea in France.
Okay. So you mentioned the conquest of Algeria and the drink becoming popular in France during and throughout the conquest of Algeria. So that's first half of the 19th century is where we're starting with the initial introduction of the French into Algeria. So what is it about the conquest that makes absinthe this popular drink? Like why is this moment, because you just described how it's a Swiss drink, there's a Swiss culture to it. I mean, Algeria and Switzerland are not exactly beside each other. So what is it about the conquest of Algeria that makes absinthe so popular in France and with the French?
Yes. So the conquest, the military conquest of Algeria started in 1830, and the French in Algeria, soldiers at the time, mainly, they were confronted with all these diseases. that they weren't used to, that they couldn't really fight, that they had no means of counteracting at the time. And so they were looking quite desperately for means to stop these different diseases. Obviously, we're still in an understanding where it's usually scent-based and air-based, these disorders. And so according to the myths around absinthe, the French army started to distribute absinthe rations to their soldiers in Algeria. So at that time, it was already produced in France, and they took it because it is such a strong smelling drink, and also because it louches. So it gives almost the appearance of cleaning the water. And that is why, according to the legends, the French army distributed it to the soldiers. Now, I am of the opinion that that never happened, but that the French soldiers in Algeria took absinthe as a form of self-medication to protect themselves against these disorders. And it's kind of a random thing that happened. It could have been a different drink, but it turned out to be absinthe that was chosen at that time as this medicinal drink with medicinal properties.
How did they get it? If it wasn't being issued by the military, where were they getting their absinthe supply?
Yes, so it seems to have been, so from the, so 1830 was the military conquest started, and from the 1840s and 1850s, I have come across bans of absinthe in the French military. And there they talk about the canteens. So that's, you know, the people who followed the army selling the soldiers their necessary items, and that they very often included absinthe as a necessary item for the French soldiers in Algeria.
So yeah. When you're looking at the conquest and the soldiers who are there, how are you finding this evidence of absinthe consumption, right? If it's not being issued by the military, if you're finding traces of it in the canteens, are there materials from the soldiers themselves? Is there written material that you're finding that can give you some insight into these myths and legends?
Yes, so that's very much something that still needs to be done. There hasn't been all that much done on the history of absinthe overall. So I looked at the published sources on the drink. And I have also looked at publications, letters, etc. by soldiers, and I haven't come across absinthe in those. So I've been looking at governmental reports on the situation. I've looked at newspaper articles, and then I've looked at the publications by French military doctors who wrote about the situation specifically in Algeria, the health of the soldiers, and how to preserve their health. So that was my intro into this topic. Yeah.
And for the material that you're finding, I mean, this happens in, I would assume, most conflicts, but I mean, I've read about First World War, Second World War, where alcohol was part of rations that were given out frequently, part of it to calm people down, part of it to give courage, sort of pseudoscientific material. In the case of Algeria, is there something, you mentioned the environmental side of it, like, and sort of the myths that come out of that. Is there any legitimate basis for those myths and legends? Like, what are they? Are they born out of anything factual?
A good question. So just to say that the French army did distribute alcohol to the French soldiers in Algeria, very much so. But it was usually wine and certain spirits as well on special occasions. But I have not come across any absinthe. So was there any real reason behind this? Not really. So it's not like with gin and tonic in the British army, for example, in India, where that actually has an anti-malarial action. So it's not like anything like that. And I actually think that this concept of absinthe being medicinal, which it was very much sold as well by the absinthe producers as a medicinal drink, actually encouraged soldiers in Algeria to maybe drink water that they should not have consumed, you know, because it gave them the assurance that they were safe from the dangers of, for example, the water. So I don't think there was any medical reason that we can nowadays define behind the absinthe consumption.
Is that part of the reason why it starts to be bad? Like that military leaders start to want to push to ban it. They don't want their people to have it. Like, is that a top-down thing that's starting to happen throughout the conquest, that military leadership is really pushing to ban and get rid of absinthe?
Yes. There are several reasons why the leadership started to ban it. So you have to understand that the 1830s, 1840s, especially, that was a time when alcoholism was not yet really understood as a problem, as a diagnosis, that only really started in the 1850s. But in Algeria, the French military was confronted with those extremely drunk, dependent soldiers. And you can very early on find reports about, oh, we had to send so many officers back to France because they were absinthic, as they already call it in those sources. So they were dependent upon absinthe. And so that was, I would argue that in France, where alcoholism was not really understood as a problem throughout most of the 19th century, because the French very much had the idea that the consumption of that's the so-called hygienic beverages, so that's wine, cider and beer, was healthy and good for you, and that you couldn't become dependent on it, and that you didn't really develop negative disorders from the consumption of those drinks. So they focused very much in France on absinthe as the danger. So there was the diagnosis of absentism, a separate from alcoholism, and that this was the danger instead of the other French drinks, wine especially, which was separate from alcohol, from absentism. And I argue that this idea of absinthe being particularly dangerous started through the overconsumption of absinthe by the soldiers in Algeria specifically. So that's where you find the first notions of it being particularly dangerous towards those people who are not used to the heat in Algeria, who are not used to, you know, the environmental factors, the diseases that are prevalent over there, that it was particularly dangerous for them.
And why does that then permeate back home in France? Like, what is it about soldiers can misbehave and do bad things for a variety of reasons, right? People have been studying that for a long time. But why is it absinthe that really becomes the focus of attention for a lot of folks back home in France?
So interestingly, the popularity of absinthe was even at the time linked to this idea of the soldiers drinking it. So the soldiers discovered the drink in Algeria, came back to France, and then they publicly drank absinthe, their new drink of choice. And at the end of this very first step, it was the French bourgeoisie that started to drink the drink because they wanted to emulate these victorious soldiers because they had won in this brutal military war in Algeria. And so they started to drink absinthe in France. And while it was just the soldiers in Algeria drinking it and in France and the bourgeoisie, it was not seen as a problem. But then it spread from the bourgeoisie. And you can find in my sources very often this idea of a hierarchy of consumption. So it was fine when the soldiers drank it moderately because they had just won a colonial war. It was fine when the bourgeoisie drank it. It was still mostly fine when the artists started to consume it in France, famously, when it became the green muse of the artists. Mm-hmm. But then it was the women who started to drink it. It was the workers who started to drink it. It was also the colonized who started to drink it. And then it became more and more of a problem. But I would argue that this idea of absinthe becoming a problem, of absentism becoming this idea of a huge danger for France, of this idea that absinthe degenerated the whole of France, was based on this specific experiences of soldiers in Algeria. And afterwards also the settlers, because they also started to drink it. And they were portrayed in France. So the French settlers, the European settlers in Algeria, were depicted in France as the biggest absinthe consumers in the world. So there was this idea that they drink more of it than the rest of the world combined and all of these things.
And how much of this is purely a class-based discussion as opposed to the drink itself? Like, what is the window into the way in which class is understood and class dynamics play out within French culture based on the discussions around absinthe at this time?
Yeah, so it's hugely class-based. So around the drink, so it became the hour of absinthe, as I called my book, is this idea of that you sit down after work for an hour with friends, with acquaintances, publicly in a restaurant, in a bar, in a cafe, whatever, and you drink one glass of absinthe prepared in a very specific time. So it needs time, it needs the company of other people, etc. And then very quickly, when the workers started to drink it, there was this idea that they drank it wrongly, that they consumed it, prepared it wrongly. So they drank it pure. They didn't add water to it. They drank it quickly. They drank more than one glass. So this whole etiquette that had been established by the bourgeoisie consuming it when it was a respectable drink was not respected by the working classes. And so there was very soon this idea of it being all right and healthy if it was consumed in the correct way, as the bourgeoisie did it, and as the artists didn't really do it, but they got something else from it. They got inspiration and creativity from it. But then the workers, they did it wrong. And that was what made it particularly dangerous.
Were there other elements to that dynamic, though? Is the sense of upper class bourgeoisie folks trying to protect something, that it's not necessarily about the amount that's being consumed or how it's being consumed, but rather that you could see working class folks almost using it as a way to kind of poke at the bourgeoisie, is like, we're doing this right, you're not. And then that kind of tension playing out. Is that part of what's going on here?
Yes, very much so. So from the bourgeoisie, they interpreted it as the workers copying their habits, as trying to become more like them, in this idea of, you know, getting a moment of leisure to themselves. And so they also described it, by the way, very similarly when women started to drink it. They also saw it as women copying men and also doing it wrong. So this idea that because of corsets, for example, they couldn't drink it with water, so they had to drink it pure, neat, and that made it dangerous when women consumed it. Yes, but so it was very much from the beginning, when the workers started to drink it, the bourgeoisie interpreted it as a failed form of imitation. And that is also when you see, for example, when the North Africans, the Algerians, the Muslim Algerians, some of them, not all of them, but when they started to drink it, it was interpreted by the French as assimilation gone wrong. So they depicted it as alcohol, the consumption of alcohol being necessary to gain a certain level of civilization. But the Muslims in North Africa who were abstinent, so their consumption of alcohol was a positive thing because it would make them more civilized, but they drank wrongly, and they drank the wrong drink. So they drank absinthe, which again made this imitation, this assimilation incorrect. Yeah.
Right. And so it really does speak to the idea of what is a quote unquote proper Frenchman.
Yes. Yes, yeah. Exactly. And it's this idea of moderation as a as an a habit, as a character trait of the bourgeoisie that made the drink safe in their hands, but all the others lacked moderation. Right. And so it was dangerous in their hands. Yeah.
And then with respect to women, why was it so dangerous, perceived by these individuals to be so dangerous for women to be consuming absinthe?
Yeah, so it was linked very much to degeneration theories in the 19th century. So the idea that the children of absinthe drinkers would be sick health-wise, so physically, they were described as trembling, as suffering from paralysis, etc. And also mentally, so it was there was this idea that absinthe drinkers would, you know, become mad, go mad at some point and die of it. And so while that was also an issue connected to men workers, for example, who overconsumed to drink in the eyes of the my doctors, who belonged obviously to the bourgeoisie, it was more an issue when the women consumed it. So the women, if they had children, it was seen as a huge danger, their absinthe consumption to their children. And on the second level, it was the Belle Époque, obviously, was also a moment of women demanding rights for the first time. And very quickly, the idea of absinthe drinking in women was connected to this new woman who demanded rights for themselves. And so they were depicted in a negative way because of that. So absinthe drinking, when you see sketches of the time, you often see women demanding their rights depicted as absinthe drinkers, which was obviously a way of denigrating their efforts.
Yeah. And for women themselves who are drinking absinthe, or perhaps for women pushing for suffrage as well, are they using absinthe kind of in that opposite way of saying, you know, we are truly French, right? If it's part of the, like, if consuming absinthe in the quote unquote right way is part of being a proper French citizen, are they using it themselves in this almost subversive way?
That's a great question. I haven't really come across that. So it's mostly the descriptions that I found of these women, of these women's rights activists of the time. They were often depicted as wearing trousers and riding bikes and, you know, being on the streets, demanding rights, those kind of things. But I have not found the same images used as to describe themselves. No, I haven't, unfortunately not, but yeah. Great question.
Yeah. So what is it that leads to the push in 1915? Of course, you mentioned banned in Switzerland in 1908. Obviously, there's the timeline that corresponds with the First World War for 1915 in France. Mm-hmm. But again, they were giving wine to soldiers then. Wine production was still going on and all that. Mm-hmm. So what is it about absinthe and what is the push to ban it, and why 1915?
Yes, so absinthe, from about the 1860s onwards, there was this idea of absentism, of there being this diagnosis of absentism. And so at the beginning, it was just this idea that there could be problems associated with the drink. And by the end of the century, by the 1890s, there was really a widespread movement against absinthe. So the French temperance movement was not against alcohol, but specifically against absinthe, that depicted absinthe as a fatal drink. So this idea of, if you drink it, you will die of it. And there was also this idea of, as I said before, that people who drank it, that they go mad, and that there was an extreme violence associated with their consumption. So it was not just that men, mostly, who drank it went mad, but that they attacked others. And there was, throughout this Belle Époque, there was the idea of absinthe murders, so murders committed under the influence of absinthe. And in 1906, there was a very famous murder case in Switzerland where a Frenchman, interestingly, who had lived his whole life in Switzerland, murdered his wife and children. Awful, tragic case. And that started a whole movement against absinthe, first in Switzerland, but that also went across the border, and that was taken up in France as well. So this idea of it causing this murderous rage in consumers. And so by the time, so as I said, 1908, it was prohibited in Switzerland and also in other European nations around that same time. And it started to be discussed in the French Parliament in 1908 for several years. Now, why was it banned in 1914, 1915? It's very much the First World War, because there had been voices that blamed absinthe for the loss of France in the Franco-Prussian War of 1870, 1871. So right. This idea that the French soldiers at the time were drunk on absinthe, and that's why they lost. And that's why it came up again, this discourse, in 1914, 1915, because they wanted to not repeat the history and not have the French soldiers drunk on absinthe lose again.
Right. Where does that idea come from, though? I mean, we were talking earlier, like this book is very much about the myths and legends. Where does that idea, why does it permeate so much that it, during the Franco-Prussian War, the French soldiers were drunk on absinthe? Where does that become part of the French imagination?
It became a part of the French imagination very early on. So this idea of them having, because at that time, absinthe was particularly popular in the French cities. So there was definitely a large absinthe consumption. It was during the phylloxera crisis when there was less wine in France because the French vineyards had been decimated by the crisis. And people did turn to imported wines from Italy and Spain, but they also turned to other drinks, and absinthe became very much a drink of the masses. And it very early on after the defeat became a scapegoat. So this idea of, you know, both during the Franco-Prussian War and then during the siege of Paris, etc., of these people having done their deeds because they were drunk on absinthe. So this idea of absinthe apostles and things like that. This idea that these acts were done because these people had consumed so much absinthe started in the 1870s and was carried on, as I said, by the temperance movement as well. And so it was not as prevalent in the discourse about absinthe as the idea of the absinthe murders and the fatality of absinthe. But when it was taken up again in 1914, there had already been a long tradition of it being viewed as, you know, the thing that cost us the war, as the scapegoat for the French defeat.
Yeah, I'm wondering, like, is it purely a scapegoat, or were there anecdotal stories of actual drunk French soldiers? Like, is there anything that comes, like, is there anything that comes out of it that people are pointing to, these kind of grains of truth, or is it purely a case of scapegoating?
I mean, you know, I'm not one of the people who, I'm not going to tell you that absinthe isn't dangerous. And there were, people did drink huge amounts of the drink, and, you know, they consumed so much of it that, you know, as we know that from other forms of alcohol, it was just another form of alcohol. They consumed too much of it. They were either unable to do to perform their duties, or they became aggressive or stuff like that. So there's loads of anecdotes, loads of little stories about that being particularly prevalent amongst the French army, both in the colonies and in France itself. But you cannot really pinpoint, you know, a specific story or something like that. And it's very anecdotal in the sources. Yeah.
Yeah. Is there anything at the start of the First World War that kind of pushes it over the edge? Like, do you see a similar thing in 1914 as the Germans are initially invading, and then you have all the battles, a race to the sea, all that's happening? Is there similar claims in the fall of 1914 of, well, this happened because of absinthe? Do you see that same scapegoating early on?
I haven't really come across that, no, but there is very much the idea that we need to act now if we don't want to repeat what has happened in the past. Yeah, but it really is at that moment, it is a mix of many different discourses, anti-absinthe discourses prevalent in France. So as I said, it's often said in the secondary literature that the wine lobby worked against absinthe, and it's maybe not quite the wine lobby, but the wine lobby, for example, financed many of the French temperance movements. Mm. They worked together with the French temperance movements because they were specifically not against wine. So you have that discourse, you have the discourse, the medical discourse about the dangers of its consumption. And then you also have the criminal judicial discourse about dangers of its consumption as well. And all of this, you know, culminated in this in these years between 1908 and the beginning of World War One. Mm-hmm. So there was really a lot of anti-absinthe sentiment that finally found its way into this prohibition of absinthe in France.
Sure. Yeah. So you call the chapter towards the end of the book where you're talking about the banning of absinthe, you call it the opium of the West. in the book. I'm curious, what are the comparisons to the opium that you found? And I mean, that seems to me like something that would certainly caught my attention, would catch most people's attention is seeing that comparison. But so what is it about the way in which the two substances are perceived and sort of the ideas around them? Because both of them, I think, have a lot of preconceived notions to what they are and what they do. So why is opium, or why did you choose to make that comparison of looking at absinthe and opium, or calling it the opium of the West, at least?
Yes. So that's a terminology from the sources, this idea of absinthe being the opium of the West. And so, so obviously that's still very present in the discourses today, in the narratives around absinthe today, this idea that absinthe is different from all other drinks. And that's due to one of the components of wormwood. So there is jujon in wormwood, which can cause hallucinations, for example, but the percentage of it in a drink is not enough to actually cause hallucinations. So this idea of it being a drink different from all the other drinks is based on it, but it's not. It cannot actually be explained through that. It's just the alcohol that makes people have hallucinations and act strangely. But there was this idea very early on, from the 1850s onwards, about that absinthe did have these very strong effects on the bodies of consumers, that the minds and the bodies of consumers, that it really changed them. This idea that it was really different from all other kinds of alcohol, that if you drank any other kind of alcohol, you were not in the same danger as if you consumed alcohol. And so from the 1860s onwards, there is this idea of it being the opium of the West, of it acting in a similar way to opium on the bodies of Frenchmen. And obviously that was after the First Opium War in China. So this idea of opium being particularly dangerous was present in France. And you find in the text this constant comparison of absinthe drinkers with opium consumers. And this idea that I try to catch with the use of this terminology of opium of the West, that absinthe transformed French consumers into something that was not French. Hmm. So it stripped their identity of them, their nationality of them. And so that's something that comes up again and again in these discussions about absinthe being the opium of the West, that it turned consumers kind of into these Asian opium drinkers, so that they, you know, they were compared on these 19th century racial hierarchies to descend in this racial hierarchy, to lose their space in it and to become something very foreign to France.
So as you're looking at all this material and you're discovering sort of the ideas around absinthe and how pervasive they become during the course of the time that you're looking at, are there any specific like stories, whether it's the like myths, legends, like, but individual stories that really stand out to you as being very much representative of the way in which absinthe was thought of and discussed within French culture?
Yeah, there's loads of different anecdotes that I find fascinating. But the thing that usually that sticks with me is that this idea of the absinthe murders in Switzerland in 1905, 1906, that were really taken up in the French narratives as well. So immediately after this tragedy, it was reported that the murderer was an alcoholic, that he had consumed alcohol, but there wasn't any mentions of absinthe. And then very quickly it became this, you know, it transformed into this idea of it being absinthe. But I've looked at transcripts of the court case, and in those texts, you cannot really find any mention of him having consumed absinthe, or you can in some of them, but he consumed huge amounts of alcohol during that day, like liters of wines and cognac and all kinds of things. But that was not viewed as dangerous. That consumption was not viewed as having caused this violence. And so he either consumed one or two glasses of absinthe at the end of his day, or he didn't. I'm not quite sure. I cannot prove either way. But it's not important, because it immediately came to be seen as an absinthe murder. So this idea of because this is based on the idea of there being an acute absenteeism and a chronic absenteeism. So acute absenteeism is if you drink, for example, absinthe for the first time and you become completely drunk from it and you do something horrible. This is acute absenteeism. But there was this idea that this Jean Lanfray, this murderer, that he was a chronic absentist. So even if he had not consumed a drop of absinthe that specific day, absinthe was still blamed for his deeds and not the alcohol that he consumed, because he was understood as being a chronic absentist. So that's one of the things that really stuck to me, of it not really being important whether people consumed absinthe on a specific day, but absinthe still being blamed for their actions.
Right. And are there any parallels to discussions around alcohol today? I mean, there's been a lot in the last few years of the danger of alcohol, the health, the damage that can be done to one's health on alcohol. Now, that's more broadly alcohol as opposed to an individual drink. But are there any parallels to the discussions that you found and you were looking at from 19th, early 20th century to some of the discussions that are surrounding the consumption of alcohol now in 2025?
Yeah, it often makes me think of the discussions around absinthe. So it's not really on a global level, but in the Francophone world, the discussions around absinthe are the first efforts by the temperance movement. It's the first efforts of prohibition. And so anything that came afterwards is definitely based on the narratives established during the prohibition of absinthe. Many of the ideas that are prevalent in the Francophone world are still based on these discourses, on this idea of, you can still today in many French publications or so, you find this idea, even though it's going down nowadays, of there being a distinction between good alcohol and bad alcohol, and good alcohol not being an issue and only bad alcohol being an issue. And that is based on this 19th century demonization of absinthe. And the other thing that I often think about in these present discussions about the dangers of alcohol is just that this demonization of alcohol in general, or of one drink in particular, just doesn't seem to work. Right. So it's just this idea of, I'm not sure if that is the way we should choose in trying to make people healthier. Because as I said, during the years of prohibition in Switzerland, people started to drink it secretly. Right. Other people, when they couldn't get absinthe anymore in France or wherever they found themselves, they turned to other drinks. That's why we have pastis and anisettes nowadays. They were developed because people wanted an alternative to absinthe. Mm. So I don't think that, absinthe teaches us that prohibition of one drink or of drinks in general or something like that will just push people towards other alternatives, for example.
Right. There's the great line in the Simpsons episode where they do prohibition and Homer says, I used to support prohibition. People were drinking more. It was a lot of fun.
Very much so.
Yeah. So there's a lot in this book and we've really only scratched the surface. So I would definitely recommend it. Again, it's Hour of Absinthe, A Cultural History of France's Most Notorious Drink. Nina, if people want to pick up a copy of the book, what's the best way for them to do that and keep track of everything you got going on?
Yes. So the easiest way of getting it is if you're in Canada through my publishing house, McGill Queen's University Press. It should be available online through most booksellers. You can get it, unfortunately, through Amazon and stuff like that as well, but try and get it through your local bookshop. Yes. And I'm currently working on a very different subject. I'm working on the medical history of wet dreams, which is fascinating as well. So if people want to keep up with me, that's what I'm currently working on.
All right. Very, very different
but I'm also I'm still looking at the medical history and at the colonial world, so it's similar in that way.
It all fits into the broad themes. Yes
exactly.
And we will put a link down to the McGill Queen's University Press for the book in the show notes, so you can check it out there. Again, Hour of Absinthe, A Cultural History of France's Most Notorious Drink. Nina Studer, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks so much for inviting me, Sean. That was lovely.
And there you have it. My chat with Nina Studer, and I thank her for her time again. The Hour of Absinthe, a cultural history of France's most notorious drink. And with that, let's get right to today's historical headline of the week, which comes from The Guardian, from November 16th, 2024, by Alice Fisher, an article entitled "Return of the Green Fairy, Once Notorious Absinthe Enjoys UK Revival." And this article profiles the popularity of absinthe here in 2024-2025, noting that the projections are that sales of absinthe could reach 35 million pounds by 2026. While a lot of folks are using traditional recipes, which include, as Nina mentioned, drinking it with water, in some cases sugar, which is part of a Czech ritual of drinking the beverage. But there's also this move to include absinthe in other drinks and to diversify what it's doing. But given its high alcohol content, it's hard to do that. It's very high alcohol content. There's a bartender who's quoted in the piece noting that you can have a couple Manhattans, a couple daiquiris, whatever, over the course of a night. But the satiation point for a lot of folks with absinthe is about halfway through a glass, just given the high alcohol content. But given that, also noted that alcohol-free absinthe is becoming popular because people like the taste, they like the look. There's just a complex flavor to it. So here's this beverage that, as we talked about with Nina, and she was so great in describing this cultural history, the significance of it, the changing face of absinthe, the changing understanding of absinthe. And here we are now, 2025, and it has this resurgence. And while similar questions about the dangers associated with it are not raised in this article, questions about what it means to drink absinthe certainly come up here. So very interesting analysis here of absinthe that is focused on the UK, but definitely recommended. And as always, it is down in the show notes below. So today's historical headline of the week from The Guardian on November 16th, 2024, article by Alice Fisher entitled "Return of the Green Fairy, Once Notorious Absinthe Enjoys UK Revival." And with that, I will say thank you so much for listening, everybody. If you have not yet, please do subscribe wherever you get your podcast, like, rate, comment. All that good stuff helps other people find the show, keeps us growing. And of course, head on over to activehistory.ca. All of our past episodes are there under the podcast tab. Plus, all the great written material on the website. Encourage you to check that out. Some really good pieces recently that are touching on a lot that is going on as the news cycle is active over the past few weeks. This is a great material over on the website. Encourage you to check it out. And of course, if you want to let me know what you want to hear on the show, it's oldasnews@gmail.com. So thanks again so much for listening, everybody. We'll be back with you again next week for more What's Old as News.